Hey there, this is Seth Wires from Channel 9 coming to you from Building 10, talking more about the Windows subsystem for Linux. I'm here with Nick Judge. How you doing, bud?
Good, how you doing?
Your name sounds like you should be a superhero or something.
I should be.
You are a superhero because he's literally working on the process structure for how these things actually exist on the Bash on Windows stuff.
Yes.
So let's, for a quick overview, can you sort of remind us how this all works?
Sure. So when Deepu talked about this, let's see, it all started with a normal Windows program called bash.exe.
Okay.
And this is a user mode, this is kernel mode.
Okay.
Down here you have the NT kernel. We have a Windows service. This is the LX manager. He would call over here.
Uh-huh.
He would call down into our driver.
Effectively, it's like a driver then that's acting like Linux.
It is a driver that is acting like the Linux kernel, working in coordination with the NT kernel on other side. He would then spin up a native Linux process. So this would be bin bash. And you have all the other processes that you might run, and this thing collectively, we would call a Linux instance. And you can think of that as sort of like a container or a virtualized operating system environment.
Okay, so if you're running one or multiple of these, it's all calling into the same Linux instance.
Correct.
So my question then becomes, when I'm thinking about a process, and let's see, hopefully my operating system stuff was working. Anytime you had a process, it was always like this square, right? Where you had the call stack, where you had the program, and then where you had the heap, and then you had some other stuff.
Right.
Because those are clearly different between Linux and Windows. So how do you manage to make these processes that are not Windows processes at all?
Okay, it's a great question. I'm going to go back in time a little bit. We're going to talk about what a Windows process looks
Perfect.
Like.
Perfect, let's do it.
Once you understand that, we can talk about what a Pico process looks like.
Okay, so you're laying down, Pico process is something that maybe people haven't heard about.
Right, this is a new concept over the last couple of years, made for things like running native Linux binaries without recompiling.
Awesome, so let's take a look at this.
So same thing, user mode, kernel mode. Mm-hmm. A normal Windows process, the NT kernel has a bunch of assumptions about what a Windows process looks like.
Sure.
And has for all time. And there are a bunch of things. I'm going to throw out a bunch of acronyms and terminology, and we can go into what they are
in a second. Yeah, I might stop you every once in a while, okay?
The Windows kernel, the NT kernel, always assumes that there's something called NTDLL, which is a DLL, same concept as a shared object in Linux. It's going to assume that there is something called a shared user data.
So these are like interfaces that the kernel in Windows expects the process in Windows to have.
Exactly. Okay. It takes a dependency on them. This is how it hooks into to get the user mode process to do what it wants, how it creates new threads, delivers something called APCs, which are a little analogous to signals in Linux.
Okay. So like an interrupt from a keyboard?
Possibly, yes. Okay. Yes. There's something called a PEB, which is a process environment block. This is the user mode structure containing lots of information about the process. And then for every thread that's going to run in this process, each of these guys has what's called a TEB. And they're each going to have a user mode stack.
Okay, so what's a TEB?
A TEB, just like a PEB is a process environment block, a TEB is a thread environment block. Same thing. And there's a few other things. NT was built assuming all of this. So throughout the NT kernel, it's going to assume I can go off and reach, and I know there's a certain routine at this place because that's where NTDLL happens to live. Or I know if I write to a certain location, I'm writing to this structure.
Because there's sometimes where the OS needs to grab that user process and say, you need to die.
Correct.
Or you're falling out of bounds. Or you've called into something you don't have access to, I need to kill you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. A Pico process. So this is I'll call this NT/Win32. A Pico process looks like that.
Yeah, I mean, this is empty, right?
It is 100% empty. There's not a single thing written in this Pico process as far as the NT kernel is concerned.
So it there's no, but obviously there's going to be, if you're doing threads, or it's going to have a call stack, it's going to have a heap. It's
right.
Gonna have to, but as far as NT looking back at it, it's just something that's running.
Correct. So the Pico process work really started with going into the NT kernel and breaking apart all the places where it took an assumption on what happened to live in user mode.
I see.
So NT, when it looks at normal processes, knows it can touch all of these things. Uh-huh. The moment it says, I'm dealing with a Pico process, it says, hands off.
Have fun.
I have no clue what is in here. Instead, I will ask the driver that owns this process, hey, it's up to you. I don't know how to handle this system call. I don't know how to handle this exception. They're asking to allocate memory, free memory, create. I don't know what any of that means. Please do your thing.
It feels a little like scary. It feels like letting in that drunk bike rider into your house, you know, when your daughter's sleeping. Well, how do you control?
It could be like that, and you're that is a great analogy.
Okay.
We control this today by saying this is effectively an extension of the NT kernel.
So the nanny is always going to be sitting around being like, "Look, dude, get out of the room. You can't be in here."
And we vet the nanny.
I see.
So this has to be Windows signed code. It's patch guard protected. We go through a bunch of security measures when you're booting the system, how this is loaded, how it interfaces with the NT kernel, to make sure that this is a trusted driver.
So if there is no trusted driver, there is no analogous Pico process.
Correct.
That is ever allowed to even exist.
Exactly.
So that bike rider is not even getting into the house.
Nope.
Without this person standing there in the way to say, hey, you need to slow down.
Exactly.
Like, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, because that became like really scary for a second. But you're saying there's these two things are tied together at the hip.
Correct.
Okay. So for this case, it feels like you've made a driver for Linux. I know you're not going to be able to answer this. It feels like you could make other kinds of Pico processes in the future.
You could. That's actually where this came from. A few years ago, there was a group in MSR, Microsoft Research, working on their idea at the time was, how do we run older versions of Windows on top of new versions of Windows.
I see.
And so that's when they came and asked us for this technology. So that's how Pico processes originated.
That's amazing. Yeah. So now that we have sort of this Pico process, before the contract between NT and the processes was this way, you're saying the contract now is abstracted away from NT into this driver.
Correct.
I see. So let's talk about what the process looks like when it comes to this and the Windows subsystem for Linux.
Sure. This is when you get into some of the differences between Windows and Linux philosophy. Mm-hmm. In the NT world, as you can see, there's lots of the kernel reaching up into user mode and managing things.
Right.
In the Linux world, they don't do that anywhere near as much, which works to our advantage from this kind of model. There's very little that the kernel, or our driver in this case, has to preemptively or proactively do in this space. There's something called the VDSO. Has slightly different names depending on what architecture you're talking about. And then when you run a program when you exec, mm-hmm. the driver is responsible for doing some very basic initialization of a thread stack and a portion of the ELF binary you want to run, uh-huh. and that's it. After that, it's all driven by user mode. So it has very little knowledge about what's going on and just reacts to what user mode asks of it.
And that's interesting because that way that Linux is architected made it so that this transition was a lot easier than it ever could have been.
Exactly.
That's interesting. So let's talk a little bit about, because I know when I was working on this stuff, processes in Linux were a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you wanted to create a new process, I always thought this was really weird. To create a new process in Linux, you had to copy an old process.
Right.
And that was the fork system call.
Right.
There's no such thing in Windows.
So that is a partially correct statement.
Cool. Tell me how.
So this is, when I came back here, how I called this NT/Win32.
Uh-huh.
Most people don't know of this distinction in Windows. But it was written a long time ago originally. NT was written to be a platform on which you could support multiple operating system personalities. And this is where the term subsystem for Windows originally came from. When it was written, NT could support OS2 type apps, POSIX type apps, and something called Win32, which was new at the time. Today, until we got to Pico processes, it pretty much was only Win32 processes.
So effectively, you kind of went back and dusted off the cobwebs of the old NT system.
Correct.
That was designed this way.
Exactly. Back when we supported POSIX, NT had to have a fork system call. And it did.
Of course,
it was a real fork system call. It copy on write, it made a clean copy, a new process, but left you in the same state as the old process. It just wasn't exposed to Win32 applications.
I see.
So there was no way for them to invoke it, or if they ever figured out how to call the system call directly, you would end up with a non-working program, because all of the user mode stuff that constitutes Win32
would not be there.
They had no concept of a fork or what to do if they were ever forked.
Okay.
So in our world, you're exactly right. We just dusted off a bunch of old functionality, enhanced it. Obviously, it needed some new fixes for performance or correctness, and it was able to go right away.
That's amazing. So the other thing I wanted to talk to you about, because now that we have this notion of process, there was this stuff where we did sort of message passing in Linux. How do these sort of processes communicate now with each other? Does
sure.
it go through this?
It does. So they can communicate in a few different ways. Lots of communication in Linux is done through files, so we fully support all of that. Signals is a big one. Uh-huh. Signals is one that people in the Windows world say, what the heck are signals? These are weird. People in the Linux world say, I can't believe Windows doesn't support signals. Same thing. We actually have the low-level infrastructure to support signals. They're just they're not made quite visible to Win32 apps. It's something called APC, an asynchronous procedure call. Mm-hmm. So we repurposed that to be able to support signals in the Linux world and the Pico processes. Mm-hmm. And that's another way they communicate with each other.
So for those that don't know what signals is, can you give us sort of a quick overview and why it's interesting in this case? Because we've really talked about sort of the process by itself.
Sure.
But once you start to get a multiple process in communication, that becomes more interesting. Right.
So signals is an old Unix, POSIX, Linux concept of being able to just throw something over to a different thread or a different process and saying, hey, this happened, and here is potentially some information that comes with it, and they call it a signal. There are 32 standard ones, and then you can have custom ones after that. Each process can register a function call and say, hey, if a signal is ever delivered to me, call this function call. Just magically make it happen. Maybe I'm in the middle of doing something, or maybe I blocked a signal and said, I can't handle that a signal right now, wait till I unblock it. It's just a way of kind of asynchronously talking to another process. And so we lit that up with the asynchronous procedure call support that NT already supports.
I see. And so that is one of the situations where the driver actually calls back into one of the Pico processes.
Correct.
Okay.
And then signals are also used to deliver exceptions.
I see.
So if you have a seg fault, right, if you try to touch some piece of memory that's invalid or other types of errors like that, that will trap to the NT kernel. So instantly the CPU will say, hold on, something bad happened. The NT kernel will say, hey, I have no idea what this Pico process thing is. Hey, Pico driver, LXSS, LXCore.
Here's the error.
Handle it. We'll look at it and say, oh, we should tell user mode about this via a signal, and we'll deliver a signal back up into user mode.
And then they can do whatever it is that they do. This is pretty amazing. So can you tell me a little bit more about the shape of this Pico process, like for example, Bash, or for any program you're running, what does this Pico process look like in compared to this? I know you said there's some VDSO, but can we get more into sort of the guts of this?
Sure. Every process is gonna have a few things in it. So I'm going to draw just another one just to highlight.
And VDSO again is what?
Virtual Dynamic Shared Object.
Okay.
And on different architectures, it's called slightly different things, but it's the same kind of concept. It's a region of memory that is mapped into every user mode process, and it's shared between them.
Okay.
So it has the same data. And it's a little bit similar to what NTDLL is in the Windows world. This is kind of the kernel's hook into user mode that says, here's some helper routines. Here's how you talk to me. Like if you need to make a system call, go through here, uh-huh. and that will do the right thing, whatever that means for this architecture. It'll jump to me.
Or if a signal comes back with like a SIGINT and it puts the integer in that shared memory. Okay.
Right. So what's really neat about Linux compared to Windows here is, except for the very first thread that's created to run whatever it is you are trying to exec. So we will create an initial thread stack. We will map in the binary that you want to run, bash. Let's call it bash, right? We will map it in, or the portions that need to be mapped in to actually start running it. And then that's it. From that point on, we don't really care what happens. User mode will pick up. We'll map in glibc. There's some other things that will get mapped in here. But it's responsible for everything after that. If bash relies on 25 other shared objects, we don't know about that. Mm-hmm. They just call down to us and say,
give me this.
Here's a file. I would like you to map it into my address space with these permissions. And we just say,
okay.
Great. Same thing. They say, I want to create more threads. They, on their own, will allocate memory regions. There's a system call called clone to create another thread that we support. But again, they manage themselves. So there's very little that we have to do to get things set up, and then it's self-driven.
And this is how Linux just works, right?
Correct.
So a question about security and these kinds of things obviously comes up. Is it the same security questions that you would have with any Linux process in that regard?
Yes. Okay. So we fully support the basic Linux security model, mm-hmm. right? You have an owner group, all the different effective permissions, the capabilities, all of that stuff. And so our kernel interface honors all of that. So if you're running as root, or if you happen to have a whole bunch of capabilities, well, you can pretty much do whatever you want within the Linux instance world. Right? None of these Pico processes can go out and touch a Win32 process or even see them. It's a complete sandbox over here.
I see. So then the next question is about security. When I'm running a process, I need to effectively say chmod plus x on a particular file to do that. What kind of permissions are given to the Pico process? Is it effectively the same permissions that you would have if it was the same Linux process?
It should be identical to what you would see in this case running on Ubuntu.
Because there's sometimes when I'm trying to run a process, you have to do sudo that process.
Right.
Is that the same case here?
Yes.
Okay, so it's effectively exactly the same stuff.
Correct.
See, we keep coming back to this. It feels like literally it's Linux. Okay, so what are some surprising processes that you've seen run, or amalgamation? Is there like a huge, like for example, can you run MySQL Linux mode on this?
We have. We've played with MySQL. We've played with Node.js, Ruby, as Deepu mentioned. We played with a bunch of things, SSH. One of the neat ones that we got working, and it was hard to get to this point, but now that we've gotten here, it's a lot easier, is we've gotten GDB working.
Oh, wow. That's a new C debugger, right? Or just the debugger?
Right, it's the debugger. And we have it working enough that you could actually debug another Linux process from another Linux process, all running on the Windows subsystem for Linux. And not only, as you can imagine, a debugger interacting with another process has lots of esoteric interactions with that process in terms of suspending them, resuming them, setting breakpoints, reading, writing memory, all that kind of stuff. And what's really neat, kind of a shout out to our friends in the console team, they made tons of console improvements in Windows so that GDB is really usable. GDB can enter a windowed mode all inside one console. So you can be looking at a small portion of the source code in addition to the call stack and the commands for interacting with GDB. So it's not all the way there yet, but it's getting very close to a seamless end-to-end experience that you can actually write Linux applications, run them, debug them, all on top of the Windows subsystem for Linux.
Man, it feels like we're going back to the 70s, man. I love this stuff. I remember when I was in school, man, command line was it. We did everything in command line. And it feels like as a developer, sometimes you have sort of a tighter feedback loop.
Right.
And this really helps because I don't have to start a VM to do anything in Linux. Literally can just do it from the Pico process.
Just right there.
Well, awesome, man. You should be a superhero. We have here one of the Linux Avengers and the Windows subsystem for Linux. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9. We've learned a lot about Pico process. Thanks for being with us, bud.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. Take care.